So what we're trying to explain here today is what explains the environmental crisis, the catastrophe, you might say, that we're facing today. And I think that probably a lot of people, the majority of people are engaged with this question on some level. And particularly in Australia, I think, but also around the world, when you have things like the 2019 bushfires, it's becoming impossible to ignore this question. Unfortunately, however, there's very little agreement on the answer, like what does explain the environmental crisis. Probably the mainstream position, I'd say, which is accepted pushed by all the sort of powerful people, rich politicians and so on, is that to the extent that there's a problem, they admit that at all. It's just a matter of a bit more regulation by governments, a bit of fixing up a few little faults with the markets and so on. And this dominant position is drilled into our brains basically from birth. They may admit that there's significant challenges, but they basically say, well, it's nothing to be too concerned about. And we're perpetually on the brink of, you know, getting it all under control. We're about to have green capitalism. It's all going to be fixed up in no time. As the years go by, however, and the environmental crisis just continues to deepen, it's getting harder for them to hold the line on this. And more people are reaching for other systematic explanations for what's happening. Unfortunately, though, again, relatively few people, I think, are driven by this to a serious engagement with Marx's work on the question of the environment. And I think this is a very big shame because, as I hope to convince you, I think Marx's analysis of capitalism actually provides the key to understanding what's happening with the environment today, and to gaining a clear picture of what we actually need to do to heal our damaged relationship with the earth. And I think the lack of engagement with Marxism on this question, I think in large part stems from the association it has with the ugly reality of Stalinism in countries like Russia and China. Marxism has largely been ignored by ecological thinkers since the 1960s, with the rise of this kind of theory, because it was assumed that the environmentally destructive practices in those countries must have their root in the Marxist theory that their leaders claim to be following. And to the extent that those dismissing Marx actually referred to his work at all, the most frequent justification for their rejection of his thought was that he was a productivist thinker. The central role of labour in his view of humanity, so the argument went, led Marx to see nature merely as something to be dominated and controlled by humans in the, you know, service of unlimited production. And in the future communist society he envisaged, therefore, we could expect the same kinds of environmental problems that we see under capitalism to continue. Since the turn of the century, however, things have fortunately begun to change. Books like Paul Burkett's Marx and Nature, published in 1999, and John Bellamy Foster's Marx's Ecology in 2000, did much to dispel the notion of Marx as a productivist thinker. Today, after further two decades of research on the ecological side of Marx's thought, those who still claim his work isn't relevant to consideration of the environmental crisis today, I think merely reveal their ignorance. Marx's concern with environmental questions grew from his understanding of how humanity is bound to the natural world by a thousand threads. In fact, as Marx conceived the relationship, we're not just dependent on nature, we ourselves are part of nature. Man lives from nature, Marx wrote in the 1844 manuscripts, and he must maintain a continuing dialogue with it if he is not to die. To say that man's physical and mental life is linked to nature simply means that nature is linked to itself, for man is a part of nature. And excuse the gendered language, but that's just the standard in the 19th century. So I'm just, following Marx, I guess. In the same passage in the manuscripts, Marx describes nature as man's inorganic body. What he means by this is that when we're thinking about things that comprise the living existence of a human being, we should include alongside our own bodies all the objects of nature to which we relate ourselves, both those that sustain us in a directly physical, biological sense, and those that nourish us spiritually, such as objects of natural beauty and so on. If you don't have access to healthy food, fresh air and water, and so on. And your physical health is obviously going to suffer as a result. And the lack of any capacity to enjoy the beauty of nature, either through your contact with it in work or recreation, will impact on the enjoyment of your life more generally. Marx didn't stop, however, just with a definition of humanity that included a relationship with nature as a constituent part. Armed with this conception, he could see that in the early 19th century, our relationship with nature, and as such our humanity, was being severely degraded. Marx wasn't satisfied with just stopping there, however. So a lot of the sort of new young Hegelian philosophers kind of just stopped with, you know, what is the essence of humanity? And they said, okay, well, this is the essence and we reject society, but didn't go further than that. He understood that to really get at the root of the problem, he had to go beyond an abstract consideration of the human essence in its relationship with nature and consider the question on the level of society as a whole. And this is pretty much obvious, I think, when you think about it. Each individual must exist in a constant state of interaction with nature to survive, but no one interacts with nature as an individual. We interact with nature as part of a society and, you know, a collective, interacting collectively, I guess, with nature. The task then became to explain how and why human society had developed in a particular way through the course of history, and in particular to understand the destructive dynamics of the capitalist system that was emerging rapidly at the time. So the key to this for Marx lay in the analysis of what he called the social relations of production. And by the way, the slides, they're not very informative, they're more decorative, so don't read too much into the slides. The social relations of production, the way in which in any particular society people come together to labour to produce the things that we need to survive. The first premise of all human existence, he wrote in 1845 in the German Ideology, is that men must be in a position to live in order to make history. But life involves, before everything else, eating and drinking, a habitation, clothing, and many other things. The first historical act is thus the production of the means to satisfy these needs, the production of material life itself. So to the extent that there's a theory of human nature in Marx, it's not something that's static. It is that our essence is to labour collectively to shape the world around us in a way that satisfies our needs. And obviously that changes a lot over time. In Capital, Marx described human labour as, first of all, a process between man and nature, a process by which man, through his own actions, mediates, regulates, and controls the metabolism between himself and nature. He confronts the materials of nature as a force of nature. He sets in motion the natural forces that belong to his own body, his arms, legs, head, and hands, in order to appropriate the materials of nature in a form adapted to his own needs. The labor process, Marx writes, is a universal condition for the metabolic interaction between man and nature, the everlasting nature-imposed condition of human existence, and it is therefore independent of every form of that existence, or rather it is common to all forms of society in which human beings live. Right, so the next step for Marx was to trace the change and development of the social relations of production, the particular forms of relations we enter into in which we labour on the natural world to get things that we need, and the changes in this through history. And from this, what we immediately see is that, counter to what some people believe, there's nothing inherently destructive about humanity's relationship with nature. And that's actually an image which people might be familiar with. It was in Bill Gammage's book, The Greatest Estate on Earth, and sort of, yeah, indicates indigenous kind of fire practices in hunting and so on. So for the majority of our 200,000 to 300,000 year history of humanity, we've actually maintained quite a balanced and sustainable relationship to nature. Indigenous societies employed sophisticated land management techniques, sophisticated in the sense that they can't be replicated today because they're more sophisticated than capitalism can manage. And it's centered on the use of fire, and they maintained a relatively healthy landscape, adapted to their needs, but not, destructive for, you know, tens of thousands of years before up to British invasion in 1788. And although wherever human societies have emerged, there's been some impact on the natural environment in which they're situated, it wasn't really until a few hundred years ago that the scale of the destruction became, you know, a serious global issue. As Marx put it then in his notes for Capital, which were later published as the Grundrisse, it isn't the unity of living and active humanity with the natural inorganic conditions of their metabolic exchange with nature, and hence their appropriation of nature, which requires explanation or is the result of a historic process, but rather the separation between these inorganic conditions of human existence and this active existence, a separation which is completely posited only in the relation of wage labour and capital. It's here that I'll introduce the concept of the metabolic rift. So the exact term metabolic rift doesn't actually occur in Marx's own work. That was coined by John Bellamy Foster in Marx's Ecology as a way of bringing together the various elements of Marx's account of the fundamental rupture in relations between human society and nature under capitalism. Although Marx didn't talk about a metabolic rift specifically, literally the term, he had the word rift and metabolic in the same sentence, but not the exact term. He frequently used the word, it's quite controversial with some people. John Bellamy Foster just imputing this in Marx. He frequently used the word metabolism, which is a translation of the German word Stoffwechsel. Stoffwechsel translates literally as material exchange. Just as today, this word was in Marx's time primarily used in the context of the sciences of biology and chemistry to describe the circulation exchange of nutrients, waste, and so on in the human body and other living things. But it was also from the 1850s onwards, there was a real kind of fad of people who were, you know, like Marx, studying the functioning society, trying to take up the idea of metabolism and apply it there. And I think it's easy to see how the idea of metabolism or material exchange can be applied in this context. As I've touched on briefly already, Marx saw human labour as acting as a kind of process of metabolism where the raw materials of nature are worked up into forms that are useful for human beings. A straightforward example would be that of a basic wooden shack being constructed. So you start off with raw material, you know, some trees in a forest. To transform them into shelter, human labour is required. First, the tree has to be cut down. Then the wood has to be sawn into planks and other shapes required for the construction of the shack. And in this process, the material that comprises the tree goes through a series of changes of form until it is finally worked into a finished shack that can provide shelter. Human labour then acts on nature in a way that's analogous to the action of the human body on the food that we eat. Just like the tree that's transformed into a shack, so, for example, an apple that we eat goes through a series of transformations until it's broken down into nutrients that can be absorbed in our cells, along with waste to be excreted, and so on. And Marx applied the idea of metabolism not only to the role of labour in shaping the natural world in accordance with our needs, as well as the metabolic interaction between human society and nature. There's a metabolism within society itself. Thus, in the Grundrisse, he talks about how the circulation exchange of commodities within capitalism can also be understood as a kind of metabolism. Insofar, he writes, as the process of exchange transfers commodities from hands in which they are non-use values to hands in which they are use values, it is a process of social metabolism. So I think the circulation of the products of labour within a society can be understood by analogy with the circulation of the blood in the human body. In a healthy body, the blood transports oxygen, nutrients, and so on where they're needed, keeping the body functioning at full capacity. And so too, in a healthy society, the exchange of products should function to ensure that everyone is able to live a decent life. So what then is the metabolic rift? In the simplest terms, it's a breakdown in the healthy functioning of the metabolic process human society depends on, both in its external aspect, the exchange of material between human society and nature, and its internal aspect, the circulation of material within society itself. In pre-class societies, such as pre-invasion Indigenous societies in Australia, the material exchange that occurs via our labour on the natural world happened in such a way that the two ends of the process, nature and the useful things that we produce from it, were related in a more or less direct and transparent way. So, the raw materials that were needed to provide basic necessities like food, shelter, and so on were usually sourced, around the immediate vicinity of settlements. And in this context, it would be very obvious if some aspect of that metabolism had broken down. So, for instance, you started to cut down too many trees and, the land started to be eroded or something like that. And it would be similarly clear if the process of exchange of goods in the community broke down and the health of one section of the population began to suffer as a result. And in pre-class societies, again, it would literally mean like the society would die if that happened in quite short time. With the emergence of class society, however, where a minority of the population came to live off the surplus produced by others, the link between the natural basis of human society and the lives of those who made the important decisions became more tenuous. As Marx sees it, however, it's only with the emergence of capitalism from the 17th century onwards that the link gets completely severed. Even the wealthiest of feudal lords still had some connection to the land. And I mean, there's no feudal lords in that picture, but it's just illustrating feudal lordness. So the power of the feudal land was bound up with their particular, the feudal lord was bound up with their particular estate. As Marx put it in a note from 1844, there's a bunch of notes that didn't go into the economic and philosophical manuscripts, which are useful on this, by the way, and are being published as part of the Gesamtausgabe, the collective works, which is sort of ongoing. He said, there still exists under feudalism the semblance of a more intimate connection between the proprietor and the land than that of mere material wealth. The estate is individualized with its lord. It has his rank, its baronial or ducal with him, had his privileges, his jurisdiction, his political position, etc. It appears as the inorganic body of the lord. So if the feudal lord failed to manage their land sustainably, if they just logged all their forest, if they poisoned the waterways and so on, this wouldn't only undermine the source of their material wealth, which comes from the peasants that work that land, but also their identity and being as a lord, their political existence and class identity as well. So the alienation of the land, its reduction to the status of property that can be bought and sold, is what for Marx constitutes the foundation stone of the capitalist system. The wealth and power of the capitalist class doesn't depend on their possession of this or that particular piece of property, but rather on their control over capital. Capital can include physical property, such as farmland, machinery, factories, offices, and so on, but by its very nature, it's fluid and transferable. If a capitalist buys up some land and then destroys it, they can simply take their money that they've got out of exploiting that land and move it somewhere else, buy up some new land to destroy. And at the same time as it completely severs any semblance of connection with the land among the ruling class, capitalism also severs it among workers. The peasantry under feudalism had a direct and transparent dependence on the land for their subsistence. But this came with a degree of independence that isn't afforded to workers under capitalism. The peasants had to give up a portion of their produce to the lord, but outside of that, they were relatively free to labour as it best suited them. And no matter how unfree they were in kind of a social, political sense, you know, a lot of them couldn't leave the land if they wanted to, their capacity to sustain themselves is at least guaranteed by their direct access to land and the possession of the tools necessary to work it. So for capitalism to be put on a firm footing, this direct relationship of the peasants to the land had to be severed. They were, over a number of centuries, forcibly freed from the land through the enclosures and literally forcibly with violence, in order that they could be free to be employed in the rapidly expanding capitalist industries. Workers for Marx are defined by the fact that they control no means of production of their own. They're no longer dependent on the land for their subsistence, but rather on the preparedness of a capitalist to exchange their labour power for a wage. To the extent that they might still maintain a more or less direct relationship with nature in their work, they have very little control over or even a stake in that at all. Their dependence is on the wage they receive rather than on, for example, the continuing productivity of the land on which they work, unlike the peasantry. If the land is destroyed by their work, it's still the case that they just rely on the capitalists for a wage. So it doesn't appear that it's directly related. So many workers under capitalism, of course, are concerned with the destruction of the environment. But unlike with the peasantry under feudalism, where the need to maintain a sustainable relationship with the natural world was very clear and immediate, the question of environmental protection under capitalism doesn't appear on the surface to relate to our immediate material needs in the same way at all. And this combination of factors, the capitalist class not having any real incentive to protect the environment and the working class having no control over it, lies at the heart of capitalism's unique destructiveness. The logic of capitalism is one in which maintaining the health of society's metabolism, either externally in its relationship with nature or internally in terms of the distribution of goods within society, only features to the extent that it assists with the further accumulation of capital by the ruling class. So the one thing the capitalist class cares about above all is profit. No matter what else the consequences, whether on the environment, health or so on, they can continue to expand their pool of capital, they'll see it as a success. And due to their lack of means of production and dependence on selling labour in exchange for a wage, workers have been forcibly harnessed to the same destructive wagon. And that's just a picture of Manchester during the Industrial Revolution. So to understand the idea of the metabolic rift a bit better, I'll go through a couple of examples. And for Marx and Engels itself, and people probably could be familiar with this, they were writing at a time when capitalism was still only in its infancy. And for them, the increasing split between the country and the rapidly growing cities illustrated the point most clearly. So in Volume 3 of Capital, Marx explained how capitalism reduces the agricultural population to an ever-decreasing minimum and confronts it with an ever-growing industrial population crammed together in large towns. In this way, it produces conditions that provoke an irreparable rift in the interdependent process of social metabolism, a metabolism prescribed by the natural laws of life itself. The result of this is a squandering of the vitality of the soil, which is carried by trade far beyond the bounds of a single country. Apologies for the slightly crude diagram. So prior to the emergence of capitalism, the productive life of society was more dispersed through a kind of patchwork of villages and towns. And there was no clear divide between the city and country as there is today. One of the consequences of this was that the nutrients that went into agricultural production could easily be recycled back into the soil through human, animal, and plant waste. Once capitalism's drive to accumulate kicked in, however, the imperative was to centralize production in order to increase efficiency, reduce the costs of labor, and so on. Industry became more and more concentrated in growing urban centers. And the waste from this human mass, instead of being recycled back into the soil, was simply dumped into rivers or the sea. And as well as making cities like London unbearably smelly and disease-ridden until they put sewers in the late 19th century, this dynamic also led to declining soil fertility, which worsened as the 19th century progressed. And during this time, farmers became really desperate to find alternative sources of nutrients for their soil. And the first thing to go rather darkly were the bones of humans who died in major battles like the Battle of Waterloo. They literally went and dug up the bones and put them in the soil to help their crops grow. And then they discovered that guano, which is more commonly known as bird shit, contained high levels of nitrogen and phosphorus that's necessary for crop growth. And there was a global scramble to secure supplies of that, even resulting in a short war. In 1856, the US passed the Guano Island Act, which saw it annex and occupy over 100 islands in the Pacific, which had lots of bird shit on them. Yeah, it was a pretty shit war. Sorry. I didn't even write that down, just because. So the disruption of one aspect of the metabolism between human society and nature led immediately to the disruption of it in other areas. With the focus on short-term profits, the idea that actually you'd build a system to recycle the waste from the cities back into the agricultural areas didn't even enter the frame. Why would you invest in a scheme like that when you could make, you know, millions of dollars importing guano from distant Pacific islands? Writing again in Capital Volume 3, Marx summed up the situation, arguing that the moral of history is that rational agriculture is incompatible with the capitalist system. And I think that looking at the situation today, it's very hard to argue with this. Massive amounts of labour and resources are spent artificially maintaining the nutrient levels of the soil, and more forests and other crucial ecosystems are swallowed up in the constant drive to expand agricultural production. And meanwhile, the majority of the nutrient-rich waste that we produce in our cities is still being thrown away. All right, so the other example which I want to talk about, which Marx and Engels didn't, but is important for us, is climate change. So I think that the centrality of fossil fuels to capitalism is, for a start, directly related to the drive inherent to the system to liberate the process of capital accumulation entirely from any natural constraints. Fossil fuels had the advantage over other 19th century sources of energy like water mills of being easily transportable and being able to be switched off and on at will. And this meant production could take place 24 hours a day independently of climatic conditions or any other external factor, and could be geographically located wherever it was most advantageous for the factory owners. And this is actually one of the things that drives the growth of cities from the early 19th century onwards. So instead of having to set up in regional areas where local traditions of working class solidarity could be hard to break down, industry could be clustered together in one place, forcing masses of workers to relocate and producing huge pools of unorganized labor that could be exploited at will. And I think, you know, even putting aside the question of global warming, which they hadn't sort of discovered at that time, I think the widespread use of fossil fuels in a society which had a healthy internal and external metabolism might likely have been rejected on the basis of its many other damaging aspects. But of course, with the emergence of capitalism, the only goal that came to matter was the accumulation of wealth in the hands of the captains of industry. And there's perhaps never been a commodity more profitable, more convenient for the capitalist class than fossil fuels. And today, I think the metabolic rift that underlies the climate crisis is obviously even clearer, but we're seeing the effects of it. Scientists have known about the damaging consequences of burning fossil fuels for over 50 years now. And we've also long had the technology to begin a transition to alternative sources of power like wind and solar. Despite this, though, and despite, you know, the warnings becoming more and more urgent, and for anyone who saw Jamil's talk yesterday, you'll, you know, understand what I mean, global emissions are today higher than ever and, you know, rising rapidly. And millions around the world are already suffering for an increasing frequency of all the, you know, extreme weather events, bushfires, storms, droughts, and so on. So what explains this failure to act? I think a big part of it is, again, this kind of rift that those with their hands on the levers of power within capitalism are those who are reaping all the benefits of the continued use of fossil fuels, while those who are feeling the impacts of climate change the most are those with the least power to do anything about it. Never has there existed a class of people so absolutely cut off from nature than the capitalist ruling class of today and their political servants. I don't know why, for just one basic thing, like people think that the capitalist class are going to act. I don't know why we'd expect them to act when the damage they're causing, you know, to the environment, their immense wealth can actually act as a shield to the consequences of it. They're not the people who are going to be suffering or who are suffering now. Yeah, I was hoping for that reaction. Hopefully there's no Elon Musk supporters in here. And I think there's perhaps no better expression of the physical and spiritual chasm that's opened up between today's capitalists and the natural world on which their wealth ultimately depends than the fad, which is personified, I think, in Elon Musk for the colonization of space. It's very telling that the idea of building a new civilization on Mars is so popular with these people. They have so little sense of their connection to or care for the natural world that the idea of interplanetary escape seems more realistic and attractive than any real effort to fix the problems that we have on Earth. And seriously, if anyone thinks Elon Musk is doing anything real to address climate change, I'll argue you down after this session. He's trying to prolong the use of cars. He hates public transport. I'm not going to go into that anyway. Hopefully no one thinks that. Okay, so to finish, how did Marx foresee that the rift between human society and nature that occurs in capitalism could be healed? The fact that this rift is grounded in the fundamental economic structure of society means, obviously, that a bit of tinkering here or there is not going to work. Again, this is, don't read too much into this. Marx was a smoker. It was very bad for his health. I don't support that. So Marx was unambiguous on this point. To really heal our relationship with the earth, we need revolution. At the heart of this revolution will be the destruction of the system of private property in which the natural environment is reduced to the status of a commodity to be bought and sold. The healing of the metabolic rift begins with the return of the land and the means of production required to work it into the hands of the working class, and also all the other means of production as well, which builds up on top of that. So I'm not going to talk about in detail what this looks like. Hopefully people have picked up some of that from other talks at the conference. The main thing, I think, is the collective democratic control by workers over the process of production, as well as the distribution of products among the individual members of society. So in the terminology of this talk, we might say the conscious democratic control over society's internal and external metabolism, a control which would enable us to quickly identify problems and adjust our practice accordingly. And also, I'm talking about international socialism here as well, so on a global level. So to take just one example, which again, Jamil sort of covered a bit in his talk, in a socialist society, which is based on the collective democratic control of production by workers, the current formidable barriers to the global shift away from fossil fuels would disappear. There'd be no more entrenched economic interests fighting tooth and nail to protect their profits. And people in developing countries, the immense majority of the world's population, who are currently suffering the most from the impacts of climate change and who are the most powerless to do anything about it, would finally have the power and the ability to have a say in what we actually should do to address it. And we could at last have a genuine discussion and debate about the way forward, actually informed by the latest science, instead of the mess of misinformation and corporate propaganda that we're bombarded with today. And we'd be able to mobilize immense new resources that in capitalism are bound up with useless or destructive industries like military, policing, high-end housing, you know, luxury travel, the list could go on and on. So to hopefully sum this up, I think the main difference and the thing that would represent the healing of the metabolic rift would be that instead of everything that happens in society being geared towards the generation of ever greater profits for the ruling class, we could actually be thinking about what's good for society as a whole. And for Marx, of course, a healthy metabolism, which ensures both a sustainable exchange of material between human society and nature and a circulation of goods within society that provides everyone with the things that they need to live a decent life, was the key to a healthy society. And there are just two quotes that I want to finish with that I think sum up the Marxist view of the relationship between humanity and nature quite well. And the first is from Russian Marxist Nikolai Bukharin, writing a few years after the 1917 revolution. "No system," he wrote, "including that of human society, can exist in empty space. It's surrounded by an environment on which all its conditions ultimately depend. If human society is not adapted to its environment, it's not meant for this world, All this culture will inevitably pass away and society itself will be reduced to dust. And I think really that's the situation that faces us under capitalism today. And the second quote is from Marx himself in volume 3 of Capital. And when I'm saying this quote, keep in mind the quote I had before about the sort of personification and identification with the land that occurred under feudalism, and then think about that as it being established again, but on the level of the collective democratic system of control by workers collectively. He writes, from the standpoint of a higher economic form of society, private ownership of the globe by single individuals will appear quite as absurd as private ownership of one man by another. Even in entire society, a nation or all simultaneously existing societies taken together are not the owners of the earth. They are simply its possessors, its beneficiaries, and have to bequeath it in an improved state to succeeding generations as good heads of households. And I'll finish there.
Well, thank you, James, for that excellent talk. I'm now going to open it up for discussion. So, comrades, for a very interesting discussion. I wish I could have called more, but very fortunately, I think, got to give James some time to sum up. But, but I'll give it to James.
Okay, well, thank you. That was a really, really great discussion, as people have said. There's quite a few things that I want to go through, so I'll try and run through it pretty quickly. First, on the question of forwards or backwards, I definitely don't think we can go backwards. Don't get me wrong, feudalism was pretty grim for a lot of people, and I don't think we want to go back to that. But I sort of do. I'm a bit more on the Darren, possibly romantic side of things, a bit on that question. And I think that I did say in the talk, like, pre-class societies obviously impacted nature and, you know, changed it in ways people said. But the damage that they caused, you know, it's like someone mentioned that, you know, they had to move every now and again. Indigenous societies, they were, you know, overfishing or whatever. But then they moved because it enabled nature to regenerate. The damage relationship doesn't become terminal until you have the metabolic rift that you get with capitalism. But I'm definitely not saying that, you know, that other societies didn't damage nature at all, whatever. Someone said something about abundance. This might be controversial, but I don't agree really with the conception of kind of luxury space communism that, you know, we're going to have unlimited abundance and everyone's going to have a Ferrari under socialism. Like, what we can do is have a society where everyone has what they need to live a good life, which would mean that the majority of people in the world today would have much more than they have now, and a small minority would have less than they have now. But, yeah, I don't think that we would have complete abundance where everyone can have their own spacecraft or whatever some people sort of seem to think. The question from Sam in Queensland about how to remove the incentive to destroy the environment after revolution, I agree with what Jeff said about that, which is that I don't think there is an incentive under capitalism even for the working class to destroy the environment. Already millions of people around the world suffer through pollution. Millions die every year from pollution. Billions of workers already are facing like a future of, you know, calamity from climate change. And already people are suffering, you know, drought and so on. It means people literally starve. These people don't have an incentive to contribute to environmental destruction. The only reason why nothing's happening about it is they have no power to change it. Like, as Jess said, they're not all like, you know, right, I'm ready to go out and overfish the ocean so that we can all starve in like 10 years' time. Like, these people are wage workers who have to do what their boss tells them. When you get rid of that relationship and you just have workers collectively working the land, you know, working industry, you can say, okay, well, we're doing this thing that's damaging. Let's not do it anymore. We'll probably all be happier. So, I think that's pretty straightforward. The thing that Diana said about wanky small L liberals, like Malcolm Turnbull, I agree with what people said about that. One is that it's very unlikely to happen under capitalism at all. Like, it's not happening. So it's like, yeah, okay, Australia could become a climate superpower. We could put solar panels out in all the deserts and whatever, but it's not going to happen because the fossil fuel economy dominates the economy in Australia. And, you know, that's continuing to happen. They're expanding gas production now. They might have these ideas. They're never going to happen. The other thing to mention there is imperialism. Part of the reason why I think that'll never happen is that for a country to build itself into a, you know, climate change, renewable energy superpower would require undermining, to some degree in the short term at least, their military capacity, which a country like Australia is not going to do in the context of a rising superpower like China. Other environmental challenges, climate change is just one among many. Like, another terrifying one, which I read about, Erin Brockovich actually had an article recently about this, about the presence of, I think it's PCPs and plastic kind of chemicals in the environment, which are leading to rapid declines in fertility rates. And a study was done recently that showed on the current trajectory, average fertility rates will be zero by 2045. So climate change is not by any means the only existential environmental challenge we face. If we don't do something about it soon, then we're basically doomed. The final thing I'll say is, like, related to the question of, like, do we as socialists have to be devoted to climate change as an issue that we campaign around because it's the most urgent challenge? I would say the answer is no. And the reason I think is because the solution to the environmental challenges we face is in workers' revolution and workers taking control of society for themselves, collectively organizing things, which I think means anytime workers are struggling, anytime there's struggle where people stand up, feel their collective power and get a sense that they can, you know, actually control things for themselves, make decisions for themselves, the BLF being a very classic example of that, that is an environmental struggle. So it's not just like campaigning around climate change that is the thing. We want to build up workers' struggle wherever it occurs into something that can fundamentally challenge capitalism. And that's the project that we're all involved with. And I'll finish there.